Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, it's me, Mike. I run the Sonar Podcast Network, the very one you're listening to right now. I love podcasting and I love the Canadian podcast community. And if you're a podcaster, work in podcasting, or just someone who loves podcasts, you're going to want to listen up. I'm proud to announce that I've been working very hard behind the scenes on an incredible podcasting event in Toronto on June 6th, the Soundwave Summit 2024. And as a Sonar listener, you get 15% off on all tickets with the code SONAR15. An awesome group of podcast companies and creators have banded together to create a space for podcasters and fans to build community, share knowledge, and celebrate indie productions. There will be a ton of informative sessions all day, including talks from Canada Land, Vocal Fry, Black Canadian Creators, Lead Podcasting, and of course, from us, the Sonar Network. And in the evening, there will be a showcase of live podcast recordings from Blacklantic, Squirrel Talk, and the Women of Ill Repute. And it's all emceed by the amazingly talented and Survivor-winningest host of Happy to See Me podcast, Erica Kostupinen. Join us for insightful workshops on podcasting, networking with industry pros, drinks, and overall amazing opportunities to meet and collaborate with like-minded podcast lovers. Come for the sessions in the day, the live podcast showcase at night, or better yet, come for the whole thing. Tickets are going fast, so get them now at thesoundwavesummit.com. And don't forget to use the code SONAR15 for 15% off all tickets. That's SONAR15. See you there.
Hello.
Hi, and welcome to a shush.
Shh. I'm watching a movie.
The Minnesota. This is a mini.
Yeah,
miniature episode. Or Minnesota.
A smaller. Yeah. Less work on my part. I love it. Big fan.
Alex, you should still give it a listen over because once you left in me talking about Vanderpump Rules when we did a Minnesota for like the last like 8 minutes.
And then I had stopped recording.
You had stopped recording. So it's just me on my end. I'd be like, oh shit. And then like literally like 8 minutes and I go like, oh no, I've been okay. And then just, but I literally was talking, it was right in the heart of like the summer. Black Lives Matter movement was going on. It was a real politically tense time, as it always is. And I was talking about how I love the Vanderpump Rules, but they're all like known racists to the point where they were fired. And I kept saying what a bad person I am for watching it, but you didn't like hear the other side of the conversation. So it's a real collateral move on Nexium collateral. Anyways, we're doing movies and TV shows that we've watched over this past, I'd say for me personally, like 2 weeks. Yeah. The amount of media that I've taken in since December 1st is appalling.
I mean, it's only going to get worse. Like no one's going to be, you know, like you're not going to watch less media coming up.
Oh, no, no. And like people are they've been filming since the summer, thank fucking God. So there will be new stuff happening.
It's going to be less new stuff, you know?
Yeah, I know. It'll be shorter episodes. Like, Euphoria is only releasing 2 episodes. And anyways, we are doing a lot. We're doing a lot of content, so we should get into it.
This is content that either is a TV show or something that we don't have enough thoughts to fill a whole episode with.
Or something that I thought Alex would watch, but he didn't, and vice versa.
Yep.
We'll start with something that we both watched. I have no idea how you feel about this. Mank. Yeah. We watched the Netflix David Fincher movie, Mank. That feels like it should have come out in theaters if theaters were a thing.
Oh, yeah. It's I guarantee you they do like an Uncut Gems or a what was the other Netflix produced
Roma
or whatever, yeah, where they like put it out in theaters for like a month and then it was on Netflix. I think that was it's Oscar bait. Like it's 100% trying to be.
It's so Oscar bait. And like in terms of Oscars, what I think I mean, who knows what anything's going to be this year? Like, I guess the Golden Globes aren't happening.
I thought the Oscars weren't happening either.
I heard they were. I heard that they are.
Oh.
Yeah. They just changed their rules. You're allowed to be on TV, basically. You're allowed to nominate TV movies. But the cinematography, like the photography, the color of the actual, like it's a black and white movie, is so beautiful. And it's stupid that I watched it on my laptop.
The cinematography is really good. I think I wish that they kind of did like what they did with The Lighthouse, where like they shot it with black and white cameras.
I still haven't seen The Lighthouse.
We gotta do it.
You have to force me to watch.
Where they shot with The Lighthouse with black and white cameras, and I think it shows. Like, whereas with this, when you like digitally make it black and white, it gets a little bit like blurry in ways, and like it the depth and contrast isn't the way that it looks on black and white film. And that being said, I think it's very pretty.
It's pretty.
The reason I want
on purpose.
Yeah. I think a lot of like out of all the digital black and white movies I've seen, this is definitely the one closest to looking like a old timey black and white movie. I realized that I have a feeling when I told you to watch it, I knew what you weren't going to like it. I had a feeling you weren't going to like it.
I have so many. It's so confusing.
I'm sorry. I was going to say that I don't think I liked it. I don't.
It's really hard to like a movie like this with all that we know as audiences. I find like someone like Gary Oldman's performance. What am I going to sit here and not say that it's an amazing performance? Of course,
it's great.
An amazing performance. He's an amazing actor. The dialogue is amazing. But it's to me, it's very shallow. Like there's nothing to hook onto. I don't care. And boy, oh boy, if anyone could make a film with more themes that I don't give a fuck about, it is this movie. Save for the political stuff. I kind of like that part.
So like the reason why I was like, I wanted you to watch it and I wanted to talk about it was that is like, I went into it being like I'll watch a David Fincher movie. I'll watch a bad David Fincher movie. Like I don't like, I think he's a very... He's always interesting, you know.
Yeah.
Even if you watch like Benjamin Button, I think would be the only movie I would put worse in the catalog of like what I enjoyed and didn't enjoy of David Fincher. Benjamin Button's probably the only movie I would put below Mank. But even then, it's interesting. Like even then, like Benjamin Button's an interesting movie.
Benjamin Button's. I only saw it once, but I don't remember. I didn't hate it. I remember thinking it was absurd, but I didn't hate it.
Yeah, and I think with Mank, like the stuff I really liked from it, I think it's got a very interesting script from his deceased father. But I think it needed like a little bit of zhuzh to
his
make it work.
And deceased dad. David Fincher's dad wrote this.
David Fincher's dad retired from being a journalist and then wanted to write a movie. And Fincher was like, "Well, write something that you'd want to see, and we'll look into
that
it."
That makes so much sense.
And then this is the script that came out. I assume there was like other drafts that Fincher did and whatnot, or other writers did. But his dad is the sole credited writer on it, and is now dead. And he's been trying to. It's been like he wanted to make it for the last 10 years, kind of thing. And
he
I should think have
made it
that
10 years
much...
ago. It should have come out at the time of the artist.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Continue.
I think that if he I don't know, man. I just watching it, I was like, oh, there's like in the core like a very interesting question that when it was written was not as in the forefront of our political mind about media and the intersection of media and politics and money and all those things. And the fact that my knowledge of Citizen Kane wasn't super helpful in this movie, but my knowledge of Upton St. Clair was extremely helpful to help me understand the movie is, I think, very interesting.
so that's like, a big issue that I had with it is, I have knowledge of neither of those things, and it never really, like, I know yeah, about.
It does not hold your hand. No, it does not hold your hand.
So, like, I know about Hearst. I know about, what's his name, yeah. Louis B. Mayer. I know, yeah. Like, these are all names I know, but I have no, like, knowledge beyond that. And yeah, I knew and that Louis B. Mayer, I watched a movie, and I'm pretty sure he was, like, the Russian mob, or, like, MGM was involved with the Russian mob, and they just, like, didn't talk about that. Anyways.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, like, old Hollywood is a very fascinating, interesting intersection of money and power and politics and all those things, so it makes sense this is there. I think, like, the most telling scene that was like, oh, this movie's gonna be more interesting than I thought is when they, when Mank is introducing his brother to Louis B. Mayer, and they're walking and talking, and then he's just like, I gotta do this thing real quick, and then goes and tells all the staff they're losing half their pay.
And, yeah, I know.
and then they applaud him for it, and then, like,
yeah, I know.
And like them backstage are like, yeah, this is like, I've seen more desperate people do less kind of thing.
That must be modern. That part, I feel. Anything to do with, like, the Republicans versus the Democrats, that all feels very of, like, the last 2 years.
Well, that's what I think was very interesting about I was, Upton St. Clair is a weird figure of that he gets, like, decimated in that election. But what that election was more was he was playing the old game of politics and the Republicans were playing the new game of politics.
Which is lying.
And Upton St. Clair was also like a 1930s depression era socialist. Like, he was, he makes Bernie, like, he's the political figure that, like, would be like Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders, you know?
Oh yeah, I know. And the way that they announced that he's lost, it's like, is it boy? What do they call him? Like, I can't say the word.
Bolshevik.
Bolshevik Russian.
Yeah.
St. Clair, yeah. Or a good Republican, blah blah blah. Yeah. Like,
yeah, yeah. And so I think all that stuff's really interesting, and I think that was more the stuff that definitely interested David Fincher in the movie, and I think it was also stuff that interested his dad. But they were kind of tied to these two things that I think make it very hard to watch, which is that it's very obviously very concerned with the making of Citizen Kane, something that I don't think anyone involved creatively really cared about, and also very
about making of Citizen Kane,
yeah, yeah.
Not the making of it. It's as if someone would film me and you brainstorming about something.
I mean, we release a lot of podcasts of us brainstorming sequels to movies that we'll never make.
That's like, we're gonna write.
That's different.
My Best Friend Wrote Notting Hill 2, and we're gonna write Notting Hill. I'm really excited to write Notting Hill 2.
Notting Hill 2 is honestly feels more fun now than My Best Friend's Divorce.
Well, like,
Notting
Hill 2 is very. It's harder to do. Both in
Best Friend's Divorce is way harder. Best Friend's Divorce is way harder. At a point. Oh, the other thing it tied itself, which is like, yeah, it tied itself to the talking about making a movie, which is really hard to dramatize and really hard to make interesting. And it has to do a lot of work to make that happen, where the meat of the movie to me is the Upton St. Clair, his relationship to the Manx conflict of being like, I'm making effectively the world a worse place. I'm part of this machine making the world a worse place.
Yeah, and I know that was successful.
And against my politics.
Yeah. I thought it was really successful at that, and I liked that was the best parts, was like, it's kind of like this guy who's kind of like a shithead anyways, but he has the right kind of politics, and so you kind of like feel for him. That's the only that's the only thing you feel for him. What I found,
which is on by design, like that's what I liked about it, like the
I
whole
hope
thing
it's
of
by
like
design. Otherwise, but, what are we doing here?
Why would you include the scene where it's like the, what do you call it, the like nurse is mad at him. And it's being like, you got to stop. And like the secretary to the nurse, like, you got to stop giving him alcohol. Why do you do whatever he says? And it's like, because he freed my family. Like, I'll do whatever he wants. It's like, the reason that scene's included is to be like, yeah, he's an asshole, but he's like, he cares about people. And the people who you in theory are like the slick talking, like the B. Mayers, the Hearst, even the mistress that Amanda Seyfried plays is like, they don't care about people.
I'm sorry.
They care about themselves.
Is she a mistress?
Yeah. So that's you got to know shit about Upton St. Clair. And
they just have
and
nice
Hearst
conversations with each other.
No. She's the mistress of Hearst. Yeah, and her and Mank.
Yes. Okay. So I misread, and I thought I was waiting for an affair with Gary Oldman, and I was like, you know what? I really don't feel like watching that. And then I was like, oh, they're just having nice conversations.
Yeah, and I think you could, and like his wife talks about I'm tired of being called
poor Sally.
Yeah, poor Sally.
Oh, poor Sarah. Poor Sarah.
Yeah, but yeah, and it's like he's not having an affair. He's having these emotional affairs. It's like he's someone who cares about people so deeply. It kind of hurts him. It's like the character they're drawing, which I like. Like I like that story. Yeah, keep going.
No. I hate when I have this opinion on movies because it's kind of like I'm not critiquing the movie itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't give a fuck about an alcoholic man. I don't give a shit about any of those people. How flippant he was with money and the depression, how he is a shitty guy, but at deep down, he has a good heart. I think a lot of women have hit their limit. And the difference would be like if we were watching these stories and men evolved over the years. But men are not evolving. No one's evolving. We're just supposed to catch the signs of them being empathetic.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm done. I'm bored. It's boring. And it's and all the women were exasperated wives or like caricatures. Like I read an article saying Amanda Siegfried get ready for her Oscar. Are you fucking kidding
fucking
me?
That character? Okay, sure. All right, whatever. But
it's not even a slight against her as an actor. In what way is that person supposed to win an Academy Award with that writing? And I'm not surprised that a journalist wrote this movie because it literally is two people sitting and talking and you get to know the politics and like the environment, but you have no idea who the people are.
Yes. So that is the other thing that I think the other thing in this movie that it ties itself to that much to its detriment is the formalist style of the 1940s movie. It leads to a lot of those two people talking scenes. It leads to the very slow dissolves. It leads to like a story of an alcoholic man is like fits the mold, man. Like it fits it. And I think the story is I disagree with you slightly on being like I think there are space for those stories, but I think I don't think this one's interesting enough to
do it. But how many of those stories can we watch? How many of those stories can we watch?
How many stories can you watch of a fucking hero saving the day? I don't know, man. There's hundreds of stories. All stories are kind of the same.
Yeah, but those
That's
movies don't get respect. Like, this is what I mean. Like, a hero saving the day, a rom-com, all that stuff, that is considered trash. But somehow, like, this stuff we're always supposed to, like, it's like, we're supposed to like pay attention to and give awards
to. This is trash. I stand by that this is trash, but I think something being trash doesn't take away its value.
No, but I also don't think that what I'm saying is a criticism because it's not a criticism of the movie. It's like my bias coming to it, but at the end
it's a criticism of culture.
It is culture. And I think that David Fincher should be embarrassed that this is the type of work. Sorry. I know that it's a love letter to his dad that he's putting out in 2020. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing that it's an all white cast, that it's all white males of 40 years old. That's embarrassing. Yeah. And I know that that's there's nothing you're going to do that's the story, but it's like a Netflix. That's embarrassing that you gave money to that.
I think embarrassing is the wrong word, but I agree with the sentiment.
David Fincher, you want to make this movie? Fund it yourself.
I think the reason this is on Netflix is effectively fund it yourself.
David Fincher signed like a $400 million deal with Netflix like 5 years ago.
Yeah, to make TV. Mindhunter. And he wanted to make movies. He doesn't like making TV. He's talked about it. And so that he's, so this is, I'm sure this is the, like, you know, like the what's it, Christopher Nolan would do a Batman to do his Inception.
Continue.
Yeah. You know, but this is him doing the Mindhunter.
Yeah.
So he can do the
Mindhunter.
Mindhunter is great. I love Mindhunter.
I love Mindhunter.
I love Mindhunter. And you know what? Here's what I'll say about Mindhunter. Even though, like, yes, there is a female character with a lot of stuff going on in it, especially as the show goes on.
Amanda Seyfried?
No, in Mindhunter.
Oh, okay. I was like, excuse me?
No, but the majority of Mindhunter is a bunch of 40-year-old white men sitting around talking.
Yeah, but at least in the second season.
It's about so much more. And I think, like, also, Mank is trying to be about so much more.
Are white men.
Yeah, yeah.
And that shows a show about psychopaths.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a show about screenwriters in the 40s. They're all white.
Yeah, I know. I understand that. And I know yeah. What I'm saying is not a criticism of the actual
thing. I'll let it.
Now, that being said, my uncle called my mom. Yeah. He lives in Paris. He's 73. He is an actor of the bygone era. And he called my mom just to tell her about Mank. Like, he had to tell her.
That's who this movie's for.
Yeah. And he loves it. And when Gary Oldman is drunk at the end doing his long speech.
Yeah, where he says the plot of Citizen Kane to make fun of.
Which honestly is really good.
Yeah, I think.
Is my uncle. Like, he would do that voice, he would do that thing. And also, I've never seen Citizen Kane. I didn't know that it was. What do you call it? The name escapes me.
Blade Brosman?
No, the windmills. Don Quixote. I didn't know it was a thing.
Oh, Don Quixote. Yeah. I mean, it is sorta. I mean, it's been said multiple times as Don Quixote. I disagree that it's, like, I think that's the starting point and then becomes about much more than that, or becomes about slightly different. I think it's like, you know what you're saying, like, these types of movies get respect and these types of movies don't, is like Citizen Kane is one of the movies that, like, gets respect, obviously.
But also, like, created a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it created a lot of stuff. And I think, like, I think everyone looking for different, because it's got so much respect, everyone's just kind of turning it. So I believe that the screenwriters were like, it's Don Quixote. I think you watch it without that. I don't know if you pick it up on it.
I mean, but did I walk out of a Stratford production of Don Quixote because I couldn't hear him say, oh, fuck, I can't remember the name of the girl's name. I couldn't stand the white actor playing Don Quixote and saying the Spanish names. I couldn't take it. It was like nails on a chalkboard. And so in intermission, he'd already sang The Impossible Dream. And I was like, oh, that's the only song I know. I got to get out of here. Like, I can't watch him say Dulcana or whatever the fuck her name is. I can't hear him butcher. Yeah. I gotta watch this Citizen Kane. I think I'll find it boring, but I also think I'll like the story once I get through it.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, at the core of Mank, I really like the story about Upton Sinclair and about power and about money and media. I think it's a really good story, and I see a much more interesting movie than the one they made. But they tied themselves to the cult of Citizen Kane, to the cult of Hollywood, to this 1940s formalism, to if you've watched Citizen Kane, like, so many of the shots in the movies are clearly mirroring Citizen Kane shots of, like, that are, like, famous Citizen Kane shots. Like, it's being mirrored in the movie that I'm like, but I'm like, it's just so in the way for a lot of it.
I mean, David Fincher needed his dad to be proud of him. We watched, that's nice, I guess. I think my major issue with this too is I'm starting to think David Fincher, the person, I don't know if I like him.
I don't think I like him either as a person. I like him as a filmmaker a lot.
You know what? I rewatched Fight Club at the beginning of pandemic. Mm-hmm. I didn't like it.
Really?
I didn't like it. I thought that the story was really, really stupid. And I couldn't get past how stupid everyone was. And it was held with such reverence because, like, how old were we? I think I was in grade 8 when it came out.
Yeah.
And so, like, my high school experience was boys watching Scarface and, like, Fight Club.
Yeah. I think you being like, it's held with such reverence. I think it is a very silly movie, and the plot's very silly. And by being very silly, it's talking about the kind of people that held it in reverence. Like, Fight Club's such a weird movie, and, like, the people who, I say 90% of the people who really love it I wonder if we all watch the same movie, because it seems to spend a lot of time making fun of them. But I just think it's like they turn it off.
It's
with 30
that
minutes
Wolf
left.
Of Wall Street thing too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's very Wolf. Yeah, I think those two movies operate very similar to me. It's very similar, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, yeah, it's hard, you know. And like I'll read stuff about like Zodiac and how like he basically said like Jake Gyllenhaal didn't do a good job because he wasn't present in the scenes because he demanded so much of him. And they would do like 80 yeah. takes, 90 takes, and all that stuff. And I just don't even know if the 90 takes. Don't know. I don't think you're getting anything good after 20 takes.
I
unless
agree.
The scene is to be emotionally exhausted.
Yeah, I agree. I get what he's getting at of being like they even get like he's like going past the emotionally exhausted point and being like everything just feels naturally.
You know,
but I don't pick up on it. Maybe he does.
I don't pick up on it in his movies. I pick up on it on Kubrick movies.
I think that's true. That's true.
Stanley Kubrick, when he does it, I see it and I feel it. I don't agree with it. But no. Like The Shining is my favorite movie. So it's like that poor woman, Shelley Duvall. And that is a movie about like a man. You know, there's so many things. Maybe that's my issue. Is that like I hear this stuff about Fincher. And when I watch his movies, I think they are good. But they are no Kubrick. They're not even Scorsese to me.
No, so, no. Well, Scorsese operates so differently than Fincher. Like, Scorsese is such an emotional filmmaker. Scorsese is the most Italian filmmaker.
Yeah, I love
somehow
him.
Some of those films talk with their hands. I don't know how. like arms come out of the side of the TV, and he's Gangs of New York was made for money, but like arms go to the side of TV, and they're just like, hey, oh, watch out, Taxi Driver. Like,
I love it. Anyways, I don't know. At the end of the day, I think I was most angry because I read this article about Amanda Siegfried gonna get an Academy Award, and I was like sitting there being like, that can't be true. Now, will Gary Oldman, if Academy Awards exist, will he get nominated? I think so.
I think so. I think he'll definitely get nominated. I don't know if he'll win, but I think he'll definitely get nominated.
I never watched The Darkest Hour. I also hear Hot Goss time that he is
Hot
a
Goss.
Brutal alcoholic.
He looks it.
I mean, he's mean.
You don't get a face shape like that. Without drinking.
He seems mean, but that could just be me judging. Also, my favorite story about Gary Oldman is when we were kids, we went to Italy for the first time. We met all our cousins. Our cousins in Italy are great. They're such a party. And I can't remember. It was like dinner one night. And like I'm 10, my sister's 12, and our cousin's like 13. And this is in the mid-90s. I'd say like 98.
Yeah.
99. And we're talking about like celebrities that we liked. And this was the height of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. So we're always talking about Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, blah, blah, blah. And then my cousin goes, oh, you know who I love? Gary Oldman. Oh, Gary Oldman. We love Gary Oldman. And everyone at the table was like, yeah, we love Gary Oldman.
What a weird.
We were like, what? Is Gary Oldman a teen sex symbol in small town Italy?
No, they just loved his acting choices. They're like, he's a strong presence on film.
What was he in? Like The Professional?
Like
Fifth Element.
Like
what would she have seen him in? That she's
like the Luc Besson stuff? Like, yeah.
Yeah. It would have been the Professional.
I mean, like The Professional, if you're like a young teen girl and you idolize Gary Oldman, it's like you being like, oh, like I want to fuck an older man. Like that is the kind of undercurrent of The Professional if you think about it.
I know, that's a...
And not even think about it, you watch it. What am I saying? Think about it.
I mean, the thing about The Professional is Jean Reno, you cannot love that man. He's so lovable. Do I think a 13-year-old should love him? No.
No.
Oh, I don't think she's 13, I think she's like 11. Now, the next movie Natalie Portman did was called Beautiful Girls. And it's... I want to say it's Ed Burns, but I could be wrong. I'm definitely wrong. Anyways, it's like one of those like indie 90s movies that like a director, writer, like white guy was really popular at the time kind of thing. And I was listening to my favorite podcast, which is just this podcast, The Rewatchables. And they were talking about like recasting something and someone was like, you know who would have been good? It was Natalie Portman. And then the guy stops the podcast and is like, you know what we need to talk about? remember the movie Beautiful Girls where we just accepted that a 35-year-old guy fell in love with his 13-year-old neighbor and we were cool with it? And he goes, that is a wrong movie. And then everyone's like, okay, calm down. He's like, no, it's just really wrong.
Did I tell you about when I was like a teen, like an early teen, and like you discover like film, you discover Kubrick, and like when you're an early teen, nothing's better than Kubrick. Like,
I know, right?
You know, like,
it's and so then good.
So I was like, so I was watching all the Kubrick movies, and I rented Lolita. Oh. And I didn't know anything about it. I'm just like, it just said Stanley Kubrick on the cover. I'm like, it's got to be interesting.
Your parents and are like...
No, my dad was just like, why the fuck did you rent Lolita? I'm like just like very like mad and concerned and found it kind of funny. And I'm like, oh, I really liked Full Metal Jacket. So I thought maybe. And then my dad's like, that's the only correct answer to why you rented Lolita is like, I didn't know.
Was
and I
good?
Like Stanley Kubrick. I mean, it's Kubrick.
I never
like,
saw it.
I think it's, you know what? I take that back. I think it was definitely maybe a little young to understand it. So I can't give it a good thing. I think I was mostly confused by it, and I found it a little slow and small for a movie.
I think it's one of his like worst movies. I think like critically speaking.
I would have a hard time trusting any critical analysis of Lolita because. Like it's going to make you emotional to watch it, you know. Like,
it's yeah, gonna... I guess so. And then the HBO had to remake it in the 90s with Gabriel Byrne. They had to.
Oh, yeah. Where else
that's
would
how,
they
that's
be?
That's how I found out about Lolita, having TMN as a teen. Imagine being well. That was the 90s. The 90s was thinking that we were so far, like we were post racist, post sexist, all this stuff, and then the most sexist, heinous things were created in the 90s.
Yeah, no, American Beauty could only exist in the 90s. Like, it's not, like, definitely, like, not the most sexist, heinous thing that I'm talking about, but, like, it is, yeah. Like, you know.
American Beauty is fascinating, though, even though it's Kevin Spacey and it's chilling. But Alan Ball, like, he's such a little freak, right? Then he went on to do True Blood and, like, 6 Feet Under. Like, he has that in him. Like, True Blood, what a little freak that Alan Ball is. There's something about that movie is perverse. Like, that's its whole thing. So the fact that the lead character that we are going along with does something perverse is like, well, the theme of American Beauty is America is perverse.
Yeah, but it's so stupid. Like, you don't talk stupid movies.
Yeah. But did I think it was one of the best movies I ever saw in my life when it came out? Yeah.
Yeah, because you were a teen. Like,
I don't
not
even
a teen.
A teen.
You were like, yeah, you were like 12.
I was 11 when it came out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. No. American Beauty is a movie for children. I'm going to stand behind
that.
Yeah,
can we talk about... Okay, we need to move on, actually. But a lot of movies that did extremely, like, critically well and won awards that were, like, of contemporary, like, I was a teenager or I was a literal child...
Yeah.
Adults also enjoyed, and it's like, was I as smart as an adult as an 11-year-old? Like, how did adults watch American Beauty and see like the bag part and not say like that's fucking dumb? Or like, I'm trying to think what else. Like, the only movie that really holds up is something like Jurassic Park.
But like Jurassic Park is like
for kids.
Jurassic Park is for kids, and I think watching it as an adult, you kind of like. It's like fun, you know, it's like popcorn,
it's
you know,
best.
And you're like,
it's the best.
I don't know. I was thinking,
maybe
I think
as,
about that
as we
watching,
mature, movies mature with us.
Yeah. Can I actually, yeah, this is a good segue into, because I find that now where I'm like watching movies and watching TV shows where I'm like, oh, this isn't for me. It's for someone younger than me. It's for someone like, yeah, and then, but except for How To with John Wilson, which seems almost custom made to entertain me, which is a thing I told you to watch, and I've watched all of it. I think it's my new favorite. Like it's a TV show that I watched, and I was like, this is maybe the best TV show I've watched in like 10 years. To call it TV is a little reductive. To call it a documentary is a little reductive. It's just like a sliver of actual life reinterpreted and reconstructed into something new. I love it.
It's so beautiful.
I love it so much.
But I know that you say that it's for you, but the entire time I was watching it, I was like, I gotta show my mom. My mom's really gonna like this.
Yes.
Like, there's something about it that I see all ages responding to.
When I say it's for me, I don't mean like how could anyone else like this? I mean like something like is designed that hits the things I like in media.
No, totally. You know? But I feel like even like Nathan For You, which is like Nathan Fielder produces it. Nathan For You, I wouldn't show to my mom because all I would get would be a barrage of questions.
Yes.
But I know that. Well, okay. So How To With John Wilson. I only saw the first two episodes. I really, really liked it. It could make you cry almost.
Yeah, I think the first episode is like the one where I was like, oh, and like the first episode is emotionally devastating. The other ones are a little more like odd. The last episode was really, really like you feel it.
I mean, I watched it alone in my room and I laughed out loud a million times. I also felt
very funny.
Very seen with that scaffolding episode because every time I'm in New York, all I do is talk about the scaffolding. And when I was in London, there was so much scaffolding too. And I was like, oh, here we go again. But I like that he explained like the law behind it as to why.
Yeah I think with all of it, it's like, I don't know. It's tough to explain, but there is like so much of your life is kind of unexamined. And then this chooses to examine. And it's like, okay. One of my favorite movies is a thing that I've showed you, It's Such a Beautiful Day, where it's little like stick figures and it's all narrated in second person. There's a part in it where he's like, he drops his keys in the counter and he goes, oh, every time you drop your keys in the counter, I forget about it. But realistically, that is more of my life than the stuff I remember. And I think like I've dropped the keys on my counter and not thought about it more times than I have thought about it. And like, that is more of your life than the big events that you remember and talk about in those big stories. And I think like How To is about dropping your keys on the counter. And then it's like, these keys were manufactured here and blah, blah, blah. It's like, that's what makes it so fascinating. I think that's why it's like, you're like, oh, it applies to everyone. Cause it's about the part of life that is kind of like unexamined.
I think also it's that thing of like, if comedians are like philosophers and observers, this is like,
which I disagree with, but yes,
we are though. You don't think we're observers.
Yeah, but they're the dumbest people ever.
They observe something
and
they make an opinion on it, and then they say it as if it's fact. Is that not philosophy?
Fine.
Is that not philosophy? Anyways, this would be like the next. This is like the most modern form of comedy, I would say.
Definitely yes. I think yeah.
That's why it's sad.
Yeah. If you're making modern comedy, it's not going to look like Friends.
No,
like Friends makes me kind of sad, you know?
Friends is kind of sad, which is what's like, if you were to really stop and think about Joey's a great time. Ross and Chandler. Chandler is bleak. That's a bleak dude. Anyways, but I think he's so funny though.
Oh, yes.
Like, on top of everything else, like, it's very, like, subtle and all that stuff. But it's not subtle like The Office, you know, like the UK Office, where that one, like, I'm sorry, if someone didn't say, by the way, this is a comedy, like, you wouldn't really know it was a comedy. It's so dry. Where this one is, like, I think it's the best of both worlds.
It's got hard jokes in it. I never quite know what's going to happen. It's about something that I have a hard time putting my finger on, but it's definitely about something.
And I think all levels of understanding would find it enjoyable. Like, I think something like the British comedy, like of The Office, it's kind of making fun of, if you're like not getting it, it's kind of like talking down to you in a weird way.
Yeah. This is like, there's not a whole lot to miss with How To With John Wilson. You know, it's like one person talking and then like often like one-to-one images of being like, sometimes you fall over and then it's like a shot of a traffic cone falling over. And sometimes you stand up and it's like a shot of someone putting a traffic cone up. Like it's very like specific. Like there's not a whole lot to miss. I don't know. It's interesting.
It's also, I think like the keys in the bowl thing It's about something that's really important, but it's also extremely silly.
Yes. Yeah.
And that I don't think I've seen comedy do that
in a long time.
In a very long time. Yeah, I'm trying to think. That's like the point of sketch comedy. I'm like, sketch comedy has become so like verbatim what happens in real life. There's no silliness to it, or it's so silly that it makes you want to shoot silly, your brain. No.
That's something. You're talking about my favorite topic now, sketch comedy. Is like something that like I get really like it rubs so like hard on is like I think either expand on these ideas, like expand on what you're seeing. I get so frustrated of watching sketches that are in the living room at a dinner party in the office, because like those aren't your real life, those aren't from anything. Right. I think of Skechers. So how many people brought in office sketches where none of them work in the office? Like I work in an office, and like that's not what it's like, man. Like you don't talk to anybody. Like it's if anything, the very silent, the shitty place.
We can't do the office anymore, though. That's it. We're done. The office has been done.
Yeah, but.
No, like, I understand. So, like, what you're talking to the wrong person. And then, all I would do is do something during the day and then write it and bring it into the Skechers.
Well, no, but like you saying of like it's either like so verbatim or so silly, and it's like a thing that I always talk about, especially with public works, is we sometimes jokingly called it bleak comedy instead of dark comedy, of just like, oh, it's like about life, it's about something, but like we got to take it, you got to take it one remove, or it's pointless. Like we're not interesting performers. We can't sell this straight up.
This is what's so.
Yeah.
Whatever. I'm just gonna say it. This is the difference between the Beaverton and the Onion. Like the Onion is comedy, and the Beaverton is just verbatim. And I say this as someone who wrote for the Beaverton.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I think
like you see something like the Onion fucking goes for it. Like, they don't give a fuck who they offend. I'm sure they get crazy letters.
I'm sure they get wild letters.
If you pitch stuff like that in the Onion, you get told... I mean, in the Beaverton, you get told... No.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, and it's
And it's not
you're
like
preaching,
we're
you're preaching
for some,
to someone who gets told no about their comedy so often that I create the disaster. Like,
it's not like we're writing for some, like... corporation that's this conglomerate is paying us. This is my I'm gonna sound so pompous on this episode. This is my issue with performing live comedy in Toronto, because technically performing comedy in Canada, you couldn't be more free to say whatever the fuck you want, because nobody cares. No one's getting paid. This isn't like we work for NBC that is actually, I don't know, they own like fucking weapons in Saudi Arabia. Like, this isn't like that. This is, we are doing comedy for the audience, and that's it. And we are behaving as though we are being watched, and we're not. So, like, something like Second City, they used to be like, oh, well, remember the 905ers are coming in, or, like, cater to the audience. And I'd be like, actually, the audience should be catering to us. The audience is so excited to be there, and you have the name Second City, that they will laugh at whatever it is we put up there. So why not make it exactly something that we want to say?
I agree with you, and I think the problem is that when I start talking about that, and I think same with you talking about that, you're going to get a bunch of people who hear that and just like, man, these two people really want to say the N-word on stage, which is not what we're talking
no,
about.
That's not
even slightly. I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm just saying that like I think the people who then really rally behind a like not really free speech, but just rally behind being like unbridled self-expression, the people who want unbridled self-expression are then cut off the people who are like rallying around quote-unquote free speech, where they just want to say hate speech as comedy. And I hate that so much.
It's the difference. Okay, so Chuck Lorre.
Yeah.
You know that guy is too smart to be writing the way that he's writing. He's going for the easiest joke, the most obvious joke.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it feels like we have to do when we're getting paid for comedy in Canada. Oh boy, maybe you should cut this out. I would like to work again. Whatever, no one listens to this. And I just don't understand it because we're not NBC. We're not owned. Like, listen, we can bitch about SNL all we want and say blah, blah, blah. SNL is owned by the most, like, hugest company in the world. Like, we should be on our knees that they're allowed to say this stuff. Like, that is actually quite lucky that they are allowed to say that stuff, that those actors don't get in trouble, that the writers don't get blacklisted. We are of a time where that could be.
Yeah.
And in Canada, we don't even kind of have that.
I think, like, the closest comparison would be like something like the British ecosystem, where like they know they can kind of say whatever. Like, I'm heavily. They obviously there's a lot of like. There's obviously the edges of the British system are seen, and that like. There isn't a lot of like far left talk on the British, on like in British comedy. There isn't a lot of like whatever, but they are allowed to create shows about whatever they want, and it shows. And it's the reason that those are exported much more than Canadian shows, because Canadian shows are kind of like these like now we're what are we known for? Schitt's Creek, Working Moms, Baroness. Like, we're known to like fill in the warm fuzzies, which makes like a show like How To, like John Wilson. I get so mad and happy and sad when I think about it, because it's like. Like, I'm like, oh, that's like new and interesting. And he got to make it because a Canadian person.
Nathan Fielder would have never been able to do Nathan For You in Canada. And that's so stupid.
Oh, I know.
Nathan For You is so profoundly Canadian.
You want some inside shit of like.
Okay.
Now I have to cut out this. I'm definitely cutting this out.
Don't say it if you don't want to.
I'll cut it out. I'll tell you and cut it out, and then I'm trying to think of how I'm going to get back into it and make it not so obvious. Cut something out of like because Nathan Fielder pitched to everyone in Canada and couldn't get anything made, and everyone loved him and everyone loved what he had, but he couldn't.
I don't think you need to. I mean, maybe bleep out person's name, but I don't think you need to cut this out at all. That is a tale as old as time. Kenny versus Spenny.
Yeah.
They couldn't get it made. So they went and they filmed the pilot in L.A. It had palm trees in the pilot, brought it back, and then CBC was like, we'll make it.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah.
This is a real sponsored by my uncle podcast, because this is the kind of stuff he talks about all the time. Haven't Seen It podcast. Alenka hasn't seen many movies. Will likes to make drinks. Well, that's good. Me and Alex have seen a lot of movies, and we also like to drink a lot. Put them together, and you get the Haven't Seen It podcast. Each week, a special guest walks our host through a famous or iconic movie that Alenka has not seen, and Will whips up a special themed drink to go along with the episode. Very fun. Okay, finally, a movie podcast for non-movie people. Rediscover your favorite movies through the ears of someone who knows nothing about it. This show is a part of the Brain Freeze Podcast Network. Check out this and other great shows wherever you get your podcasts or at brainfreezepodcasts.com. So long story short, story is we liked How To with John Wilson.
How To with John Wilson is so good, it makes me angry.
It's very good. I'd like to meet him. There's a part in the first episode where he goes, is it Punta Cana?
Yeah.
Goes to Punta Cana, and it ends up being MTV Spring Break, and he says, which is a wall-to-wall nightmare, and he's watching a concert. Pauly D is like the overlord. Like, the writing of that is so hilarious.
Yeah.
And,
oh, no. By the time he went to...
He's not facing the stage, and he gets told by MTV that he's in every shot and he's going to have to move unless he faces the stage. And this is a guy that's just watching the audience, with his back to the stage.
When I watched the first episode, because I watched it when it came out, I'd heard, like, other people told me that I would like it. And I watched the beginning, I was like, this is interesting, but I don't quite get it yet. And then by the time I see it, it's like, oh, he's at MTV Spring Break, and the way he talks about it, and what he shows you there, and like the bit with all the pillows, and like all these things is like, I'm like, oh, this show's so good. This show's so interesting.
It got me the first two minutes when he's trying to do small talk and he talks to that guy at WWE or whatever, who says that he catches pedophiles. And then the next scene is just them like in his house being like, let's do this. Anyways, watch it. It's very good. I'm going to watch the rest of it tonight, probably.
Oh, please. It's great.
Yeah. Okay. What else have we watched together? We both watched The Crown. You haven't watched Industry.
I haven't watched Industry.
Let's talk about the Crown. Crown, because we both watched it. Crown season.
Yeah, I watched
four.
Season four. So I watched the first four episodes of it. I'm not done it. I get why you love it, because you breathlessly explained how much you love The Crown to me.
I love The Crown.
in a park like 2 weeks ago or three weeks ago.
I loved it. I just watched it 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and I fully understand. Like watching it, I was like, oh my, like this, because I'd watched most of season one and didn't really like it. And then watching this now.
Didn't watch season one.
Watching season four, I was like, oh, I get it. And it made me want to watch it to be like, how did he get to this point? Because it is about this I want everyone to realize that I'm misusing this term, but it's kind of like about like generational trauma, about like this person is hurting this way and is going to hurt the next person who's going to hurt the next person who's going to hurt the next person. Like, oh fuck, I really get the, like watching the end game of it. I really get what this show is actually about.
I really recommend, mind you, this is the only way I watched it, is watching it backwards. I really recommend season four because it's the most mainstream entertaining. Mm-hmm. And then season three gives you Charles's backstory in one of the best episodes of the series when he goes to Wales. Mm-hmm. And then two and one, I haven't finished yet. I just don't like it as much as three and four, even though it is there's no contest between the acting in one and two versus mm-hmm. the acting in three and four. Like, Olivia Colman is so good, but it's not for her. Whereas
it's like her third queen role. Yeah. Like she's always just playing queens.
Whereas Claire Foy, there's no comparison. You watch 10 minutes of Claire Foy being the queen, you're like, excuse me. She's like the most glorious actor. Okay, now, season four was just such... I think I was so overwhelmed by liking it because I thought it was going to be boring. And it wasn't. And it still was heavily like involved the politics and involved the queen.
I was surprised how much it moved, and I could kind of see that, like, by the time I got to episode four, I could kind of see the tricks they were doing to make effectively what is like 99% of that show is people talking in ornate rooms,
to make it
like visually interesting and move and like very contemporary feeling, and like I can kind of see what the tricks they were doing, and I was like, but I didn't care. I was like, I thought it was really interesting. Like, I didn't love it. Like, I'm not like going bent over backwards for it, but I'm like, oh, this is like way better than I thought it was going to be. I think the politics are very interesting. Well, I mean, obviously, politics are interesting. It's like, it's a big turning point in UK politics, but anyway.
What I like about the politics, about like the overall POV of the show, which I find absolutely fascinating, is that it is trying to show you like the human side of royalty, and it is a very like pro royal show. But I bet you if you were to ask Peter Morgan if he was pro royal, he would say he's not a royalist.
I think it's an anti-royalist show.
Yes, I do believe that's the point, but I think it's counterintuitive.
I think it's very subtly, it's trying to humanize these people, and in doing so it's very subtly saying that you don't need, like, the royalty are a cause and are a like a wedge in the machine of UK politics that would be better off without it.
I think the best episode, maybe one of the best episodes of the fourth season, is when that guy that breaks into Buckingham Palace twice.
Have I seen that one yet? I don't think so.
Oh, what episode are you on?
I'm halfway through episode four.
It might be the next episode. I won't say it then. Let's just say this guy breaks into Buckingham Palace twice.
I love that setup. That's a good setup.
And it's a real thing. And they like, they show who the real guy is at the end. And they explain what happened to him. Yeah. It's really good.
That's really funny.
I think it really, you know what it's doing? It's saying that like the royalty is bullshit, but I think the guy has true affection for Queen Elizabeth, which I don't see how you can't if you're writing an entire show on a person like this.
No, I think to tie stuff together, I think similar with like Mank, of like they have like both the like both Mank and The Crown care about people. Like they both care about like, and How To with John Wilson more than the other two, care about people. They care about like what people think and what people do, and that everyone is like human with like emotions and desires. I think they disagree with what people do for a living and in the machinations of society, of like disagrees with, like, I think the crown disagrees with the royal family, but does care about those people. And I think that's what makes it interesting to me.
Because you know what's interesting? It's like everyone who's in royalty gets born into this role, and then they are, it's like they're the people of Pompeii. It's like they're covered in this plaster cast. Every once in a while, a shred of humanity, like, peeks forward, like the queen behaves when this guy breaks in, or in season three, there's like, oh man, there's an episode where in season three, a small town in Wales, it was big news. Like, it got destroyed by mining runoff.
Yeah.
And that's literally her, like, being like, they're saying, like, you gotta go to Wales, man. You gotta go to Wales. You gotta talk to them. And she's like, but I'm a queen. I just go to church. Like, I wouldn't go to the actual town. And then throughout the episode, she's like a robot slowly becoming sentient, being like, oh, maybe I will engage with people. And it's like something that's been literally, like, ripped out of her or buried in her. And what I like about season four is that it's so actively, it shows that behavior in action with a man. So, like, she's a woman. She is really good at being polite and hiding her emotions. Charles is not good at being polite or hiding his emotions.
No, yeah.
And I think that's why it's more, like, active and more interesting. And then my theory on the whole Charles and Diana thing, which is fairly obvious if you watch the show, I personally think, so sensitive. Charles is so sensitive. And he gets beaten down to not be sensitive. And he, I mean, they make him say it to, like, his sister, when his sister's telling him, like, what, like, reading him the riot act about being with Camilla. And he's like, can you just be nice to me? I'm not asking for you to tell me the truth. Can you just say, like, I know how it feels. And so that they beat that out of him. And then when he sees Diana, who's, like, maybe one of the most ultra, ultra sensitive human beings that's ever existed on this earth, it makes him hate her. He hates that she's sensitive.
I mean, yeah, and then starts this weird, like, passive aggressive abuse campaign on her. And I think to me the most telling part of in the few episodes I watched is they have a shot of, like, the whole family, like, outside and, like, the countryside, and the voiceover is of, like, the conversation is happening is just like, watch out for them. Like,
oh, I know it. And then, like, Peter Morgan loves doing this, like, because he wrote The Queen, right, with Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
He loves comparing Diana to a buck. That's his thing.
Yeah.
She a buck, and the royal family killed it. That's, like, his whole, that's his theory. Yeah. That's, like, that's how he feels. And it's a beautiful metaphor, and I love that he's using it twice. But it is, like, the truth of the matter is that she helped kill a buck, like, the first weekend she met the family, and this buck was, like, they wanted to kill it for a while or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the actor who plays Diana is that good. Sorry.
No, here's the thing is I understood why you like it, of, like, it's this very small emotional story at super high stakes. It's just, like, that's very vitae, like, that's something you care about.
I do care.
I think there's a lot of really good performances of, like, the whoever's playing Prince Charles is really great.
Don't even get me started. And then, fucking Josh.
And then there's also some real garbage performances, like whoever's playing Princess Diana, I think, is in her own way. And then Thatcher is a cartoon.
Okay, yeah.
Thatcher is a full cartoon from a different TV show.
She gets better.
Walking into the scene. Yeah.
She gets better. I know. I know. The first couple episodes, I was like, is she good? No, she's bad. And, like, it's very confusing because she is good, but she's also very bad. Like, same thing with Diana, like, too.
Sorry.
Diana's doing, like, if you were to compare her to Diana, and if you were to compare Gillian Anderson to Thatcher, she looks and sounds like her. But it's very bad.
Yeah, but, like, she looks and sounds like her on SNL. Like, she looks and sounds like her. Like, I'm going to say this, like, I like Gillian Anderson. I've seen her in a lot of stuff where I thought she did a really great job and is a really good actor and a really good performance. But, like, to do this, like, mask performance of Thatcher is, like, so silly in a very small emotional show. I don't know.
How did she do that with her jaw?
That's what I mean. It's like I don't think she needed to do any of that.
And this is my thing, and I say this all the time, and I get very annoyed with certain casting things. Because someone like Claire Foy, I don't know what the UK star-o-meter is. I'm sure she was doing quite well in the UK. But, like, made her career. Put her in it. We didn't know who she was in North America. It made her career. Why not do that with Thatcher? You're going to sit there and tell me you can't find a woman who is Thatcher's age. Maybe Gillian Anderson is Thatcher's age. She just looks remarkable. But who, like, resembles Margaret Thatcher more and is, like, a fucking powerhouse theater actor. You're going to tell me you couldn't find that. And you're going to tell me that the audience wouldn't have loved that in The Crown. Oh, God. It already has the audience is there for it. We don't need Gillian Anderson.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who is tuning in to see Gillian Anderson play Margaret Thatcher. people were already tuning in and then being like, oh, okay. Like, it's like kind of the more response I got.
Hurdle to get over.
Because the biggest hurdle for The Crown is that it is The Crown. The biggest hurdle for The Crown is that it is, like you look at it and it's like, man, that's going to be dusty and slow. And so it's either people who are watching, people who want to watch it. But you're not going to get new viewership for The Crown.
But here's the deal about the fourth season. Like, they must have been sweating because, like, this is the hardest season to do so far because it's the one where everybody knows. Everybody knows those paparazzi pictures of Diana.
Yeah.
Everyone who's watching The Crown has a recollection of what all of this looks like now.
And that's true.
They did a very good job. It gets better. It gets really good. Just a real quick finishing on.
Yeah.
The man who plays Prince Charles, first of all, way too charming for Prince Charles himself. Like, I always have to make sure people understand, like, when I'm talking about Prince Charles, I'm talking about the actor Josh O'Connor. I'm never talking about Prince Charles. The real Prince Charles is my enemy. I think he's one of the worst people. I'm sorry that he had abuse growing up. I'm sorry that his dad was mean to him. Welcome to the club. I am sorry, but I think that his response and the way he treated Diana is despicable. Mm. And if I was his kids, yikes. But anyways, Josh O'Connor does such a beautiful, nuanced performance. And he slowly becomes king of the rats by the end of the fourth season because his posture gets more and more rat-like. And I just really like that. I think that's very special. I think it's very good. In the third season, he's almost unrecognizable in the fourth season. Because in the third,
those are the same actors?
Yeah, in the third season, he's so tender and sweet.
I thought it was a different actor. No, it was the same actor. Season.
He is this British guy who, baby boy. He is in a movie on Netflix called God's Own Country that is basically like an emotionally deep Brokeback Mountain.
Okay.
Alex, you should watch this movie.
I'll check it out.
It was going to be boring. I couldn't sleep one night and it said, you would like this. And I was like, well, of course, Prince Charles is in it. I'm going to watch this. It stays with you. It's about a guy who lives on the farm. He's an only child. He must be like 19, 20. He's like a mute. He works on his farm. He's emotionally shut down. Very much similar to the Heath Ledger character in Brokeback Mountain. But this makes you understand why he is the way that he is. And then this guy from Bulgaria comes to help them on the farm. And then they fall in love. And this guy who comes to help them on the farm is like, he's not closeted, I don't think. Or he doesn't behave in that way.
Yeah.
But this is all done through not talking. He just emotionally gets him to open up and then stuff happens and it's very sad. And it's also a very disgusting movie. Like, it starts with like Josh O'Connor like barfing. It kind of shows how disgusting it is to work on a farm.
You're selling me hard.
Yeah, I think you'll really like it. But let's just say that I thought it was going to be boring. So I had insomnia and I tried watching it. And then like, I'm like, oh boy, I can't sleep. It's both romantic and disgusting. I've never been so like intrigued. And and Josh O'Connor, I do believe, you'll hear it at first. I really think he'll win an Academy Award one day.
I mean, if the recap stuff I saw of him in season 3 and watching him even just change across the few episodes I saw of The Crown, that guy is killer. Like, that guy is...
He's killer. What are you going to do? Every so often, and more often than not, those goddamn British actors, they're just better trained. There's no comparison.
The better trained, they get... I mean, like they get more reps in. They're doing, like, more interesting theater more often.
Yeah. Like, this is, like... He's 29. He's been in, like, a billion TV shows already. You know, this guy's...
Jesus.
He's living how he's got to live, and he's super cute, and my pastime has just become seeing random pictures of him on Instagram and screenshotting them and keeping them as if it's my locker and I'm in the ninth grade. I can't do anything else because there's not that much. He hasn't been in that much that I can watch. Anyways, I think we're talking for like a good hour now.
We're talking for an hour. We did. That's good.
We could do some quick thoughts. You didn't watch Industry, eh?
I didn't watch Industry.
God, I kind of think we should save it. I think you'd have so much to say on that show.
I'll check it out. I want to watch it. I'm able to.
Once again, it's one of those. It's a very HBO show. It's basically if Wall Street was set in 2020 London and instead of Charlie Sheen, it's a black girl from New York, and I would call it sexual but not sexy. Like there's so much sex in it, but like. None of it is hot.
Here's what have you seen Black Monday?
Yeah, I watched the episode and I was okay about it. I didn't finish it.
Keep watching it. It's one of the most it's what you described about a comedy, and it's one of the most bonkers comedies that I have no idea how it was made.
Okay.
I think the first season just got a third?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very exciting. Okay. The first season just kind of gets like each episode gets a little better, and the second season is just insane. Like the second season is like wild.
I just wonder if anybody's watching Industry. I would like it to get a second season. I think it's like it takes a real interesting stance of like we like capitalism.
Okay. Yeah. I'll give it a go. I'm sure I'm gonna have a lot to say.
Yeah, give it a go. I think it's really good. I think the actors are good. Maybe you'll find it sexy because the girls do sexy things. But my major critique of the show is there's no way that any of the men could have penetrative sex because they all do so much coke. I don't understand how anyone's dick works in the show. And this guy does like so much coke, and there's like a part where he's about to have a threesome, and I'm like, yeah, the fuck, right? Anyways, that's my major critique of the show.
I think that's your episode. Rip. Want to promo the stuff we're doing for the live stream?
Yeah. Okay. Is this show coming out soon? Right.
It should come out Monday.
Oh, this is the next show. Okay, guys. So we talk about Notting Hill too, but just know that's going to be in our upcoming Notting Hill episode. Anyways,
Notting Hill's out today.
What? It's out today.
I messaged you that's up.
You did not message me, Kalingo. I didn't promote it at all. I'll promote it tomorrow. Okay. Because there's no point in promoting it now. Anyways. Guys, listen to Notting Hill. So this Saturday, I don't know what you're doing, Alex, but it's the 12 hours of Sonar Christmas. I want to say it properly.
Hold on. 12 days of Sonar.
12 days of Sonar, but it's a marathon on...
Yeah, are you doing a chunk of that marathon
I'm reading what they've posted just on Facebook. It's called the 12 Days of Sonar. We're launching our YouTube channel. So Sonar is launching a YouTube channel.
We do not have a YouTube channel.
Maybe we will one day. and Sonar is our podcasting network, if you didn't know. And Patreon with a huge celebration. Join us for 12 Days of Sonar, starting with 12-hour live stream marathon on Saturday, December 12th, 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. So I'm a part of that. I'm doing my top actor crushes of 2020. What are you doing? Are you doing something, Kalingo?
I'm doing something, but I haven't decided yet. Okay. I got to get that in.
I have to. Tomorrow I'm going to spend my day taking... making pictures of Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor. So I'll be doing that. I'm really excited. I think that'll be really fun. And so some of the people that are going to be a part of that are, you got Chris Locke, you got Spooked, you got Nostalgica, you got me. It's saying show watching a movie at 9:00. Oh no, that's on December 21st.
Yeah, we have a show on December 21st.
So confused. That's not a part of the 12-hour thing. These are the other things you can watch every night of the 12 days. And we are on December 21st at 9 p.m. I don't really know what we're doing yet, Alex.
I wanted to do the theater story thing where it's like talk about weird things that's happened to you in a movie theater.
Are we interviewing people? Are we going to get guests?
I would like to do that.
That sounds like a really good time. I think we should definitely do that.
Yeah. I want people to call in.
Let's do call-ins. That's actually so fun. Oh my God, guys, stick around. We're going to have people call in and we're going to do it like that. I wish we could be in the same room. Anyways, so that's what's coming up.
Yeah.
So watch I mean, honestly, I don't recommend watching Mank.
Yeah, I don't really recommend watching Mank either.
I recommend watching The Crown.
I recommend watching How to Do with John Wilson. I'm recommending it to everybody.
Yeah.
And I think about maybe 1/3 of people I've recommended have actually watched it, and the people who have are been like, wow, that's really good.
Yeah.
And so if I've recommended watching How to Do with John Wilson to you, fuck you, watch it.
Watch
Callum
it.
Ratton. A person I've told to watch 5 times and still hasn't.
Callum is known for our Mamma Mia episodes. We gotta have him on again. If you look at How to with John Wilson, you think that's not for me. It's not like Tim and Eric Awesome Show. It's way
no.
It lets you in way more, even though it shares like a DNA strand of that. It'll. I think it's much more relatable.
No, it's very welcoming.
It's a very easy watching. It's even easier watching than Nathan for You.
Yes.
Though I also recommend Nathan for You, especially the episode.
I rewatched it recently. It's beautiful.
Yeah, the episode where he does like blackmail for people, like if you want to lose weight, like here's
yes.
Anyways, guys, that was a great enjoy this very serious episode. It was pretty serious. I got really into it.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I mean, Mank's a serious movie.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.